For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Broadcasting from the 80 Up Studio, it's the longest-running poker podcast for the everyday poker player with your host, Joe Scales.
Hello, A-Team. It's Friday, October 27th. Welcome to the 80 Up Poker Podcast, where every hand is an opportunity, every player is a friend, and every episode is a winning experience. And I'm your host, Joe Scales. I'd like to start the show with condolences for the Brunson family once again. 5 months after Doyle passed away, his wife Louise has joined him. They were married for 62 years. Their daughter, Pamela, had posted the news saying, "I'm sure she is so excited to be in heaven with my dad." She went on to say, "Please keep us in your prayers. It's been a crazy 5 months." I hope everyone will continue to do that. I'm sure it's not been easy. There's not really an easy transition from that, so let's step away for a second and hear from our sponsor, Manscaped. This episode is brought to you by Manscaped, and they are introducing the Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra, featuring a new cutting-edge design and next-generation dual skin-safe blade heads for different shaves. It's pretty much a spaceship to take all your sensitive areas to the next level. Seriously, this is the fifth generation, and now it is a game changer. Join the 9 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with the brand new Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra by going to manscaped.com for 20% off plus free shipping with the code ANTIUP20. It's high tech for low places. Manscaped. Go to manscaped.com, get 20% off plus free shipping when you check out using the code ANTIUP20. We're getting close to the next Patreon private game on PokerStars. If you haven't done it yet, make sure you sign up for the raise level on Patreon. I'll have a link for everyone in the show description, and I hope to see everyone there. We're also getting close to the November magazine release. If you haven't had a chance to check out the October issue, make sure to do that. It's available from the website. Go to anyupmagazine.com and click on magazine to find all the issues there. That's all I have, so let's get on with the show.
Find out what conversations are happening around the poker table with Table Talk.
This week's Table Talk is a sneak peek into our November feature story. Aaron Massey recently earned a spot into the MSPT Hall of Fame, and he has worked extremely hard to get himself where he is now from a rough beginning growing up in the Chicagoland area. I was able to catch up with him and talk a little bit about that journey, and I have a small bit of that conversation here, but make sure to check out our full discussion in the November issue of the magazine that'll be out in a few weeks. I really wanted to get you, Aaron, on here and talk a little more about the MSPT Hall of Fame and what it took to get there. But also, I know this is really just the beginning of big things. I predict 2024 to be a big year for you. So first of all, thank you for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate you reaching out.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're in Vegas right now, right?
That's right. Yeah, I just got back yesterday from a long trip, couple cities. Some poker, some fun.
Well, we touched on this a little bit in the magazine last month, but I want to go a little bit more in depth. I want to go back a little bit because when we talked about your start in poker there in the Chicago area, you actually had to battle through a lot growing up to get to the point where you are now. So tell me a little bit about that first, and then kind of how that may have helped you with the success that you enjoy in poker now.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I had to battle through some adversity in the Chicagoland area a lot earlier than I started doing it in poker. I had a rough start as a kid or whatever, but one thing led to another, and I ended up in college. That's where I found poker. And when my athletic career came to an end, literally it felt like the next day is when poker was introduced to me, and I was hooked immediately. You know, I started off playing for fun, playing in free bar leagues with my brother's ID. Started winning those, and you know, it was fun and it was cool. And I used to, the grand prize was like a free bar tab at the end of the night. So when I get down to like three handed out of like 100 players or whatever, I'd call my friends to come up because $250 went a long way back then.
Right.
So I was able to buy out the bar if I won. So we had a good time. So yeah, after college, I had a real job that I was supposed to have in finance or whatever, but I was spending more time playing low stakes poker around the Chicagoland area and playing low stakes cash in local tournaments. I had no interest or passion for the job I was doing, or any job for that matter. I won chopped a circuit event in October of 2009 and quit my job the next day.
You alluded to it, but you actually finished. A lot of people that find poker in college don't end up finishing their college, but you ended up finishing with that. Was it a finance degree?
Yeah, I had a bachelor's in finance. And at that point, being a professional poker player wasn't on the radar. Like, it was certainly a dream, you know, being able to watch it on TV every day. And it was something that, like, I really wanted to do, but it wasn't like something that I thought I was going to do. I was still committed to, you know, being a real normal human being. And as the first 2 years of being out of college happened, where I was actually now playing for money and competing in tournaments where I could actually win money, you know, I went out to Vegas in 2009 for the two different little stints during the summer and like just took little shots and stuff. That's when it started ramping up. And I started playing online some. And it was all after college is when I really got the passion and thought that this was an opportunity to actually do it. And then, you know, I had my first success, quit my job the next day, and I thought I was all in the clear, just ready to take on this dream. And within 4 months, I was dead broke, no job, my girl left me, and I had some soul searching to do to figure out which direction I was going to go. And I went down to a friend's house in Florida with like $2,000 to my name. And I just hung out there for 2 weeks figuring out what I was going to do. And I decided to pursue it and got a couple friends to start backing me. And I took it from there.
So with, you know, the struggles that you had prior, you know, I mentioned that any of that you think help you have the determination and lead you to the success that you have now? Or was that all something that you had to learn on your own?
Both. But like I learned it on my own in the first place. Like, there's a lot of adversity my brother and I had to go through, several different challenges. I mean, we were never given a shot. Like we got dealt a pretty shitty hand, you know, family wise and otherwise. And so there was several obstacles that we had to overcome just to, you know, not be in jail, honestly.
Right.
And you know, not be like just a complete screw up, because that's where we were headed. And that's a likely outcome for kids like Ralph and I. So, you know, we're pretty resilient. And I, you know, certainly didn't stop when I, you know, had some troubles and, you know, had some adversity when it came to poker in the beginning. But I definitely had to really figure out if it was what I wanted to do, because I could have been very successful professionally,
right,
in finance or otherwise.
So in, was it 2010 when you chopped that?
October 2009.
Okay.
Yeah. It was like a $350 buy-in. The circuit came to Chicago at Hammond, and I had, I think I had less than $2,000 to my name. And my buddy, George, also didn't have very much money or whatever, but he saw that I had a real passion for the game, and he thought that like if anybody was going to win, it would be somebody like me who cared a lot. So even though he didn't have a lot of money, he went partners with me for you know, we're talking less than $2,000, which is a significant portion of his role, so that I could play 5 350s on the schedule. And only the 350s on the schedule. And the first one was like a record-breaking field. And yeah, chopped it for like 50, maybe 52K, had half of it, and thought I was rich. I had never had that much money in cash in my life. And I thought that 26K was going to be all I needed, you know, to take off in this life, you know? So like I said, by February 2010, I was broke.
Yeah. And then it wasn't, but just a couple years later when you won the WinStar main event, right? And then the same year, I believe, you got your first circuit ring. Right?
Yeah, that was it. It was 2012 is when it all changed. I had some minor success in 2011. I had like a couple of 40 or 50K scores or whatever. But being backed, you know, and having like some makeup or whatever, small makeup even, because I was playing small, but still I wasn't seeing a lot of that money. So even though I had a couple of results, I only had a couple of bucks. And by the time that WinStar rolled along, I had just gotten torched at the World Series in 2012. So I'm dead broke and probably had like 30K in makeup. And my brother was giving me an allowance every day to live on. And my backer is putting up all my buy-ins. I didn't have a dollar of my own. So I won and everything changed. Yeah. I went from having, you know, negative 8K that I owed my brother to, you know, having money in my account that I'd never even thought about ever having, you know, up to that point. It was a real life changer for me. And it was the pivotal moment in my career still to this day.
Who would you say was that person that took you under their wing and showed you the ropes as far as poker goes? I know you mentioned a couple of names earlier, but, you know, they were your backers, but did they kind of take you under their wing, or was it somebody else? Or
I had the passion, and I was just always, you know, studying and watching and learning and stuff. So like I credit a lot of that to myself and to like diving into it, you know. The two guys that I described before, my friend George, who isn't a professional poker player, and then Kevin Saul, who was at the time, they're the ones that jump started it. Like obviously I've had a lot of people along the way. But George was more on the life side, more on the, like, he just made a lot of sense as far as, like, decision-making and outlook and things that translate to real life as a person, as in life, and those could apply to any realm. And he was pivotal, and, like, to this day, like, I mean, I had a conversation with him just the other day about, you know, a different situation where we're just talking about life and strategy and, you know, how to handle certain situations. And then Kevin was all poker. Kevin was the first one to really teach me. And that, you know, transcended my game to a new level. Now, since then, you know, over the last 10, 12 years, I've formulated quite a nice group of close friends who are all, you know, champions in their own right. And, you know, that obviously helps, and that has taken me to a different level. You know, friends, it was Jake Baisley and then Jared Jaffe and a lot of other, you know, close friends to me, and then friends of theirs. Like, you know, I'm a social guy. I've made acquaintances with a lot of people, friendships with some, and just being around them, players that are better than me, you learn a lot.
Now, absolutely, yeah.
And then in the last, you know, 5 years, I've taken to studying, I've gotten coaching, and it's, you know, now taking it to a new level.
So let's focus then on the MSBT, because you've had so much success there. Mm-hmm. You talked about this one at Firekeepers with Bob last month.
Yeah.
You didn't even know that the event was going on, and you had someone drive you there in the middle of the night to get there and play that last flight, right?
It was pretty awesome. I'm in Chicago. I'm staying with, like, a very close friend, like a fake mom to me. Her name's Geraldine Titani. She's a very special person to me. And it was one B of C going on. Oh, okay. And I was made aware of this tournament, which is funny because it happened to me at Windstar also, where I didn't know about the tournament. And then it was a few days before. It was like, okay, we're going. It might have been like 2 days before that I ended up going to Windstar. So this was the night before. They were already on the second flight. And me and her came up. We were like, all right, well, let's just go up there. And she's like, yeah, I'll just go up there and play machines while you play the tournament. So we drove through the middle of the night. We left, I don't know, like 2, 3 a.m. It's a three-hour drive. We lose an hour. We got there. It was like 8 a.m. The tournament started at 11 for just for one seat. And I went out to win it. And she was there to rail me the whole way. It was a real special moment for the two of us. And that trophy still sits at her place.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, I've been trying to add another one to it, but you know, I got them close a couple times. But if I ever get another MSP trophy, it goes to her place as well.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you actually do pretty well at Firekeepers and the Venetian, for that matter. But
yeah.
But you do really well at those two places for sure. Firekeepers
was my spot for a while.
When we were out in Chicago early September, Labor Day weekend, everybody said we had to go up to Firekeepers. So we made the trip up there and checked it out. But it's a beautiful, beautiful spot too.
It's well run. It's well run. The staff is incredible. The poker room manager, Kelly, does a great job. And all of their staff, their dealers and their floors, they do such a great job, which was surprising to me at first because it is like a smaller type of venue compared to places like the Hard Rock or the Vegas locations. But it's fantastic. I cannot say enough good things about them and the property and the tournaments that they run.
It is phenomenal. So you're only the 12th player to join the MSPT Hall of Fame. What does that mean to you?
It's obviously an honor, and it's nice that they can never take it away from me. You know, it's something that I've accomplished. However, as time has gone by in my career, the accolades aren't as important as the money. When I was coming up, I was all about the glory and the respect and, you know, all the things that come with that, you know. And as I have gotten older, I just want to be able to continue to live the life that I've been accustomed to living. I just want to keep making money, playing a game so that I can do whatever I want, whenever I want, like I've been doing for the last 12 years. So it's great. Sense. And it certainly is an honor. And I'm grateful for that for sure. And I love the MSPT, but it's the same as if it was a bracelet. Like if I got heads up for a bracelet and somebody was like, hey man, I'll give you X amount of dollars for it. I got a price. So I'll take the money over the glory, but you know, I'll definitely take both overall.
Yeah.
Now, you want to give me both of them? Let's go.
Yeah. Well, where you've gotten to has been a long, hard road. So congratulations on that. You know, it's always a great thing when you can overcome the adversity and get there. And so, you know, I always appreciate seeing that.
Yeah, I appreciate it too. It does feel good, you know, when people recognize, you know, what you've been doing and what you've overcome, whatever. So I don't take that for granted. I have a good perspective on that, and I'm very grateful.
And I know we're going to see more from you as time goes on. So I guess my last question is, you kind of alluded to it already, but how do you keep that fire burning? How do you keep motivated to continue to learn and push for constant improvement?
I love the game, man. I love to play. I've been a competitor my whole life. And when I wasn't, you know, I wasn't cut out for sports, but I was cut out for this game. And it continues to get harder. The players continue to get better. I'm certainly not the best, but I'm good enough to compete. And as long as I got a chance to compete, I'm going to keep playing and I'm going to keep trying. I love playing poker. I love learning poker. Going deep in a meaningful poker tournament, it's better than anything else because, you know, like people always compare things to sex, right? But like, it's like better than sex because it is. You can have sex anytime you want. You can't get deep in a poker tournament anytime you want. That's not how it works. So when you do get a chance, it's like nothing else that I've experienced. And it's like nothing else that like most normal people with normal type of lives can experience. And you know, once you get a taste of it, you know, and I've had a taste, you know, I've seen the light, like it's awesome. So if anything, I'm addicted to that. But also I just want to continue to provide for me, my brother, and, you know, and just continue to be able to live the life that I've been accustomed to. I wake up when I want, I play when I want, I don't work. And I just want to continue to do that. And if I can do that doing something I love, then man, that's a dream.
Yeah. That's a perfect place to end it right there.
Cool.
Yeah, Aaron, I really appreciate you taking the time. It means a lot to me. This is my favorite part of the job, getting to talk to people like you. Like I said, I mean, I know that there's a lot more to come from you.
I'm not done. I'm just starting to cook. So let's hope they let me get hot sooner than later.
Yeah. Yeah. I look forward to having you on here again when we have you holding up that World Series of Poker bracelet.
Hey man, that sounds great. And you got me for sure. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
Absolutely.
Now it's time for Call the Floor with Elliot Schechter.
Elliot Schechter is the poker room manager for Rivers Casino in Schenectady, New York. He joins us each week to say how he would rule on situations that come up in your games. And he's with me again this week. How are you doing, Elliot?
I'm doing very well, thanks. Things are going nicely. How you doing?
I'm good. How's the weather in your area now?
Warming up again.
Is it?
Yes. It's back in the 60s. We're supposed to be in the high 70s on Saturday.
I don't know that I would call 60s warming up, but okay. All right. Well,
we had frost on our cars a couple of days ago, so 60s is warmer.
Okay. Well, we have a Call the Floor this week sent in by Alan Smithy, which...
is the name directors use when they don't want to put their name on a bad film.
Yeah. We'll just go with it. And I think it's an interesting spot. But we'll just jump in here. He says, uh-huh. I'm playing in a tournament when the following happens. Three players see a flop of all clubs. Player A checks, player B checks, and player C goes all in. Player A thinks for a bit before sliding out a stack of 1K chips. So player B goes all in, then player A tosses in two 5K chips, and player B tables a king high flush. Player A mucks his hand. Player B insists that player A called his all in when he tossed the two 5K chips into the pot, but player A insists that he only called the first all in from player C. The floor is then called, and the floor calls the lead floor, who is currently not in the tournament room. In the meantime, player A goes outside to have a smoke. The lead floor arrives a couple minutes later. We all explain what happened. Player A comes back toward the end of the discussion and says that the lead floor needs to go to surveillance to verify that he never called player B's all in. The floor tells him that this isn't necessary. It's not worthy of going to surveillance because he'd have to pause the entire tournament to do so. And rules that even though he no longer has a hand, player A is liable for calling both all-ins. He tells player C to table his hand, which is the ace of clubs, seven of diamonds, and has the dealer run out the board. A fourth club hits the turn. Player C has 24.8K, and the floor uses A's stack to pay that, then pushes the rest to B. And obviously, player A is livid. So the questions are, after all of that, and I know that was a mouthful, but the questions are, was the lead floor right in refusing to pause the tournament in order to go to surveillance? And was this even the right call? And then he says, the first stack player A pushed out only totaled 14,000, which means he may have actually felt like those two 5,000 chips he tossed in were just making the pot right, not calling the second all in. So did player A get shafted?
There's a lot to unpack here, and there's actually a couple questions that still need to be asked. But was the lead floor right in refusing to pause the tournament in order to make the surveillance call? In this case, yes. We try to avoid that whenever possible. Let's face it. I mean, generally, especially in some of the larger events, there's a lot of people. I mean, you pause the clock, all of a sudden, you've got several hundred people and dealers just sitting around doing nothing.
Right.
Agitation spreads quickly, and all of a sudden, the place is burning down. So, yeah, avoiding going to surveillance and stopping the clock? Yeah. It's certainly something we try to do in almost every case. Sometimes you got to do it. Let's face it. Sometimes you've got a pretty tough situation to solve and a tough situation to explain to the players for whom you're making a decision. So sometimes that clock's got to stop. I mean, you just can't have one table completely out of action while you're processing this and everybody else is playing, especially if the blinds are substantial enough where people are getting eliminated every hand.
Right.
Now you've got 8 people who can't get eliminated. They're moving through the money ranks while everybody else is going bye-bye. So sometimes you have to stop the clock. We try not to, but sometimes you do.
Right.
So in this case, once again, while there's a lot to this situation, at its essence, it's not that complex. Stopping the clock here would have been fairly wrong. Let's go back to the action itself. Player A checks, player B checks, player C moves all in. Player A calls that all in by moving chips forward. Player B, obviously with enough chips to reopen the betting, moves all in. Player A then puts more chips in the pot.
Right.
At this point, 2 of the 3 players are all in. Something not said here needs to be said. Why is the dealer not stopping the game until all the hands are face up? And if somebody's refusing to turn a hand face up, why are they putting it in the muck? Why are they not calling the floor then? Exceptionally important, and something that was absolutely overlooked in this entire situation. And at that point, we would have realized that player A might not have actually called the bet like he claims.
Right.
I'm not going to give them much mercy at this point. It was their turn to act. They placed chips in the pot without saying a word. Any floor person is supposed to rule that acknowledgement of a bet and accepting the action. You call. Congratulations. Put your money in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really simple way to avoid that, right? Just make your intentions clear, as we've said numerous times.
Speak up.
Yeah.
And again, if his intention was to fold, why did he wait to see the other guy's cards before mucking his hand?
Right.
All he had to do was let go of his cards as soon as the other guy put more chips in the pot. So there is no evidence to speak of that player A intended to fold to any of those bets.
Right.
There just isn't. Therefore, he's liable for all the action in front of him. Tough. Yeah, this is not a complex one, which is why I wouldn't have stopped the clock. I would have moved chips off of A stack. If it takes all of them, it takes all of them. I would move the chips off the stack to the correct players and move on, deal the next hand. Player A wanted to raise hell. Player A is going to have to get up and talk to me way away from the table because I'm not stopping the clock for this. This was not that complex on the surface.
Right.
I appreciate that A made it complex, but again, he made it complex because his intentions were not clear.
Yeah. You know, if he just says, I'm folding, here's my chips to make the pot right.
Right. Or slides his cards forward at any time.
Yeah.
Prior to putting chips in the pot. And then we'll just ask him to make up the bet from the first part of the bet.
Right.
The player, C all in. So again, yeah, moving chips forward, hanging onto your cards, those are rather symptomatic of calling a bet in front of you.
Yeah.
So yeah, we only diagnose the symptoms.
Right. I like that saying. I think we should start using that more. We only diagnose the
symptoms. The doctor is in.
Yeah. So it is pretty cut and dry, like you said. There's a lot of things that go on here. I think that, you know, you could definitely say that the way player A did that, putting the chips after the fact, you could say that that was kind of an angle shot.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
Inadvertent or otherwise.
Yeah.
You're getting free action. And it was a double all in. I mean, too many bad things went down because A didn't speak up. So was it an intentional angle shot? Possibly. You can't for certain say it wasn't. Absent more evidence, I'm certainly not going to accuse a player of cheating. But there's reasonable suspicion here.
Yeah.
That's why the rules are in place the way they are. If you intend to fold, get rid of your cards. If you intend to fold, don't put more money in the pot.
Right.
Until you're asked. Speak up when necessary. Live with the consequences otherwise.
Right.
It's not our job to be psychic. I have to let the players know many times. One of my guiding principles, making decisions. If I have to read your mind, you cannot win. When you put me in a spot to read your mind and figure out what you're thinking, I'm going to make a decision that's the simplest, fairest, and will generally almost always be ruled against you.
Right. Right. Well, I do appreciate you sending that in. And if anyone has another call to the floor that they would like Elliot to rule on, send that to podcast@annieupmagazine.com. But other than that, Elliot, I appreciate your insight, and we'll talk again next week.
Glad to help. Love doing this. Please keep sending those submissions in. This is a pretty interesting one. Loved having this discussion.
Agreed. Agreed. We'll do it again next week.
Absolutely.
Let's break it down with Hand of the Week.
Here we are with another Hand of the Week with Patrick. Hey, man, how you doing?
I'm good, Joe. How are you, man?
I'm good. So our Hand of the Week, sponsored by Jackpot Digital, their electronic poker tables. And I'm telling you guys, if you haven't checked these tables out, you have got to look at the video. Just go to the magazine and on what I think it's page 6 or something like that, there's the video there. Check out that video and see all the options that it gives you, because it is an incredible tool.
Oh, there's no doubt. They are so cool. It's unreal what they can do.
I would definitely recommend checking that out. And if you see one of these in the casino, because they're really starting to ramp up getting these installed in casinos, which is really cool to see. So if you see this, sit down at the table and check it out. It's awesome. It's an awesome, awesome tool. But hey, man, we've got a Hand of the Week this week. Did you study up for your stud 8?
Bring it on. I love it. Who sent this in?
Todd Lemansky, actually, our LA ambassador.
That's right. Yeah.
He actually sent this in a while back. This is a hand that he played in a mixed game tournament there. He went pretty deep. This is actually at the final table. Day 3, we're at the final table. There are 6 players remaining. And we started the day with 835,000 in chips, which is 5th. We're 5th in chips out of 6.
Okay.
Limits are 40,000, 80,000. And this is the last hand of this particular game of stud 8.
Okay.
After paying the ante in the previous hands, we actually start this hand with just over 800,000. So all right. That's right around 10 big bets. Seat 2 will complete with the 2 of clubs visible. So he's got his up card as the 2 of clubs. And we look down at the 2 of diamonds, 4 of hearts, and our up card is the 6 of hearts. So now your options are to call, which would be the 40,000, raise to 80,000, which would be 2 bets, or fold.
All right. So talking this through, I've got 2 of diamonds, 4 of hearts, and 6 of hearts showing.
Yep. 3 to the low.
A little bit of straight draw there. I think I'm going to call the 40. Nothing, you know, nothing great, but I mean, it's not a bad hand. I'm definitely playing, but I'm going to call the 40.
Yeah, I think in this particular case, it is a pretty big hand because you have pretty strong low, but you also have the ability to get a straight draw. You get the wheel where you could really scoop, which is your goal in this when you're doing a split pot game. So this is a strong hand. I would probably make it 2 bets here. So
okay.
The only thing you have to think about is that with the 6 of hearts as your up card, then, you know, you're not going to surprise anybody by coming up with the low, you know?
Yeah, for sure. They already see at least one. So your betting is going to go that route.
Yeah. So Todd actually makes it 2 bets here as well.
Okay.
Which I think is the right play. So seat 6 calls with his up card is the 8 of clubs. and seat two calls as well. So we're three-handed moving forward.
Okay.
Both players are pretty competent players, as you may expect at a final table. So
yeah.
Fourth street, seat six gets the ace of spades. Seat two gets the 10 of clubs. And we get the jack of diamonds. So our hand is the two of diamonds, four of hearts, and then our up cards are the six of hearts, jack of diamonds.
And the other seats are eight of clubs, 10 of clubs, ace of spades, what?
Ace of spades, eight of clubs. So seat six bets and seat two calls, and it's up to you.
I don't really like the jack of diamonds there. It doesn't really...
Yeah, it's not great.
It's not great. I'm probably going to call.
Okay. So what's your reasoning for calling there?
So I still have a few streets left. I still feel okay about my hands. I know we are already two bets based on what we had gotten, but jack of diamonds doesn't do me anything there, and I don't put anything else extra in. That's kind of my thought process.
Yeah.
Is that off?
No. I mean, I call as well, I think.
Okay.
But I think the main reason that I'm calling is because our opponent's cards that we can see, they don't have any of our, they don't have our suits. They don't have any of our cards. So we have everything live, right? Diamonds, right. Hearts, the jack, the two, the four, the six, none of those are in our, well, I guess the two, seat two as our two, but other than that, we're in good shape to improve. We don't know what the up cards for the players not in this hand, those that have folded, we don't know what those cards were, which in most cases is something of note, but without that, I still feel like we have a lot of potential, so... Yeah.
Didn't you say it was what six seated to this table? So there's what three extra cards out there that we could have seen.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
we don't know what those were. So I make the call here. If we would have looked at those cards and seen a lot of diamonds or a lot of hearts or something, I definitely could let go of this. So
yeah.
Todd says he decides to peel one more on the cheap street, since the jack is diamond, and I think that's fair. Fifth street, seat six gets the five of clubs. So now he has two clubs showing and definitely could have a low of some sort, right? Ace 8-5 right there.
Yep.
Seat two gets the ace of hearts. So of note, he takes one of the aces that seat six could be looking for. And we get the six of diamonds. So we show a pair now.
We do.
Our bet now on this street has to be the big bet, so 80K. And we would have to act first because we show a pair for the highest visible hand.
Yeah. We show a pair. Still got diamonds. Low is still in play. I'm definitely... At this point, I'm going to go ahead and bet the 80K. Are you thinking check?
Yeah, I think that looks like it could be a good card in some cases, but I think it actually makes things worse for us because we still have to hit runner for just about everything, right? Our low draw, the diamond draw. If we want to hit a straight, it's still runner.
True.
So I think I check here, and I don't know. I'd probably even fold to a bet, honestly. I mean, I could see some cases for making sets and boats and yada yada, but I feel like it's all hopes and dreams.
To do that.
Hopes and dreams.
Ifs and buts for Katie and yeah. I get that. That's a great point. What's our friend Todd do?
Todd bets.
Okay.
And both opponents call.
Oof.
So we go on to 6th Street, and we get the 4 of diamonds. So now we have two pair and a diamond draw. Seat 6 gets another 5 with the 5 of spades. Okay. So he shows a pair of 5s. And Todd said he doesn't remember seat two's card, but it was something low. So seat two has the two of spades, ten of clubs, ace of hearts, and something low.
Something low. All right. So it's still to us because our pair's showing pairs. All right. So we've got our diamond draw. We've got two pair. So at this point, this is like what you and I were talking about. You know, where do you, you know, don't miss a bet. You know, make sure you get the value out of it. But I mean, this is right back to hopes and dreams.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because a diamond comes and everything's great. A four or six comes, everything's great. I think even given the bet on the last one, I mean, we're showing three diamonds now. I don't know what it would say, but I'm probably checking to see if I can get everyone to check with me to go to the last street. But that would be my thought process, at least.
Yeah, I think it's important to also note that three of our four diamonds are up cards. So
yeah,
the flush isn't going to surprise anyone if it comes in.
Right.
Pairing our four takes away any chance we had at a low.
Yeah.
So that's out the door. If seat six has an ace as one of his down cards, that would be a better two pair than ours, even though seat two has one of those aces. It could also be another five under there. So I definitely think I check again. Hope they all slow down. Todd says, now I have two pair and a flush draw, so I bet again. So he bets.
Okay. Keeps the pedal down.
And he says, something I did with little thought, which is why I can't remember seat two's card. Based on the strength of my hand and because it appeared that both players were chasing lows, they both call.
Oof.
So Todd says, I brick on seventh. So we did not get any of our draws. And he says that he went ahead and checked. Seat six bets. And seat two calls. What are you going to do?
Have a nice day, guys. bite my lip and you know, pass him in. Because, I mean, there's no point at that point, I don't think. I mean, it doesn't matter what you bricked with. I mean, it doesn't matter at that point. You've got nothing. Even if they were chasing lows, and they didn't get it, I mean, there's too much out there possibility-wise that you probably are beat, even with the two pair.
I agree.
Right?
Yeah. Even if your two pair is good, are we just playing for half the pot? And if that's the case, then it's not worth it to hope that it's good.
The theme of this hand is the hopes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. yeah. I feel like one of them for sure has the low. My guess is seat two has the low.
Yep.
And this is where I kick myself for even chasing to begin with. Maybe we should have folded a street earlier.
Yep.
But I fold on this one. Still leaves us with like just over 500,000 in chips. Not great, but we can still make some magic happen with that.
Oh, for sure.
But Todd says the pair I have showing is bigger than seat sixes, and one of these guys must have a low based on the action. So I'm calling for half the pot, and I should fold because it feels like I'm beat. But the pot is so big, I decide to call. I lose to seat sixes, aces up. So they did have a better two pair. They had an ace in there. Yep. And seat two's 6-5 low, and they chop up my money. he puts in here some things to consider. So on 4th Street, he says, should I have folded? He says, the magic 8-ball says, as I see it, yes.
Again, I mean, it's clearly I do not play these, you know, stud very often at all. But going through it, yeah, I think he's probably thinking the right thought process. I mean, you said it right there, you know, because we're talking when the jack comes out. And at that point, you know, again, we're chasing runner.
Yeah.
It's a lot. And with that type, especially in the tournament, the big bet, I mean, that's you're throwing away a lot of possibility for very, very little value at that point. I mean, you don't have anything to run on. So, yeah, I think him Monday morning quarterback in his own hand, yeah, I think you probably do.
Yeah, I can see making the fold there. I don't think it's a bad call, though, because, again, our opponents don't have our cards or suits. So I think the call's fine there. I think Fifth Street was more of a mistake. He says, should I have check folded? I bet because it's better to bet if you plan on calling. But yeah, I don't think anybody's folding there. So this is more of a mistake than Fourth Street because, you know, runner's tough at that point.
Yeah.
And then on Sixth Street, he says, I remember thinking I still had a low draw to go with my two pair, but that's not the case. Oh, and he says, which means I misread my hand. I think just judging from what he's saying here, if he doesn't misread his hand there, then he probably does slow down and save a bet, which is what it's all about. If they bet and you decide to call, you're no worse off, right?
Right.
No worse off than you would have been. So you're actually, if you lead out, if you bet out, then you're not giving yourself a chance to save that bet. And then he does mention, actually, also forgot to look at the other boards to see how many of my fours, sixes, and diamonds were still alive, which is a major aspect of the game. And that's what I was saying earlier.
Right.
On 7th Street, seat six bet into my sixes with fives and one player in between. So both opponents have aces showing and called two bets pre. This is a clear fold. Magic 8 Ball agrees without a doubt. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, the 8 Ball and I agree. So, yeah. I think the main things, limit poker is all about making and saving bets. On 5th Street, you still save three big bets if you fold from that point. So I think that's where the mistake is, more than the streets prior. Yeah. I know Todd mentioned, you know, folding on 4th Street, you could save a little bit in hindsight. But I think it's fine there. I think the two bets on 3rd Street's fine. Making the call on 4th Street is fine. It's 5th Street and beyond that I would say that's where you check save fold. The bets.
Come.
So, and there's your stud 8 hand.
There it is. You know, all right. No worse for the wear. Did Todd happen to say how he ended up finishing? He was in 5th out of 6 going into that.
He did say, and I don't remember, it's been a while since that took place, so I'm not 100% sure on that.
Cool.
He had a pretty good score, and we actually talked about it on the podcast at one point, but I don't remember what it was. But yeah, he did all right just to even get to that point. And then the thing I remember about this tournament is it was a pretty stacked field. I do remember that. And so for him to even be able to final table, this was pretty impressive.
Nice.
We'll see if we can sneak in another non-hold'em hand or if we get hold'em back next week.
You know what? I got the hang of it enough. I've got the idea. I think it's definitely, like you said, it is a different animal with, you know, the big bets there of, you know, making sure, like you said, getting the value of it or, you know, saving it for that, you know, saving your bet. So it's a different mindset. It's fun to do though.
Yeah. Yeah. Limit poker is definitely a different beast for sure.
Yeah.
But it's fun. It's a different kind of strategy, which makes it fun. But you did all right. You held your own.
Yeah. Appreciate that. See what our listeners think. They see the novice held up.
Yeah, they may have a different story.
We'll see. They're like, listen, Patrick, just stick to what you know. We'll see. Maybe just, you know, practice makes perfect. So maybe we do need some more of these.
Yeah.
Very nice.
All right. If anybody has a hand of the week that they would like Patrick and I to break down, be sure to send it to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. Send us your hold'em hands, your stud hands, your Omaha hands, whatever. Send it in. Let's put Patrick to the test for sure.
Bring it on, everyone. Let's go.
All right, Patrick, I appreciate you. We'll see you next week.
Sounds good. Cheers, guys.
It's time for Joe's One Outer.
What's the longest poker session you've ever had? I've always been fascinated with the Wild West, where disagreements were settled in corrals at high noon and the saloon was your second home. But it was also supposedly where the longest poker game the world has ever seen was played. The game went on continuously for 8 years, 5 months, and 3 days. Longer than it takes to become a doctor. And it all went down in the basement of the Birdcage Theater in Tombstone, Arizona. You know Tombstone, the place famous for the shootout at the OK Corral. But let me put this nearly decade-long poker game into context. The average American's life expectancy at that time was only about 48 and a half years for a man and 51 and a half for women. So an 8-year-long poker game, that's significant. Of course, no player sat there for every hand of that 8-year game, but the game itself never stopped. The owners of the Birdcage decided to capitalize on the lifestyle of the miners and businessmen in the area by starting this high-stakes poker game. To join, the players had to pony up a $1,000 minimum buy-in, and the claim is that an estimated $10 million changed hands. Now, I don't know what that works out to be in today's dollars, but that's a lot of money back then, and 10% of that went to the house. So I think it's pretty clear why the game didn't end for so long. Over the years, the game saw just a revolving door of players. You had players that were reputable businessmen like Adolphus Busch, the co-founder of Budweiser, George Hearst, California senator, but you also had Doc Holliday, Bat Masterson, and Wyatt Earp. You'd think that in a time like the Wild West, the game probably ended because of a shootout or a holdup or something. Although I hear there were a lot of bullet holes in the walls, it was actually the nearby mine that dried up and the town's economy tanked, so the owners of the Birdcage moved on too. I mean, if you really think about it, the Birdcage took 10% of the money that changed hands. So things haven't really changed all that much. Just a lot less gunfire. That's today's One Outer, and that's today's show. I'll see you next week, A-Team. And until then, I'll see you at the tables.
The Annie Up Podcast is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcasts@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call the show at 540-339-7741. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to editor@AnnieUpMagazine.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.